John Blank by John Agard. In Norman French, the name has a ring that's nice. Not John the Blanc, Jean Blanc, to be precise. Shall we say a Tudor gentleman of colour? Or one who brought colour to the Tudor court? What's in the name leaves ample room to ponder.
This is Writers of Mosaic in Conversation. Michael McMillan talks to Michael Orojuru about his pioneering project on John Blank, the first recorded black man in British history.
How did you come to this, to the project?
Well, it all goes back to my Fanuary Open University essay, which I did on the black magus, the black king in the adoration scene in the Bible. And the black king, there was an image in Devon of a black king in Devon 1520-ish. And I wrote about that. And I just became captivated by the black king because there's thousands of images of him. You know, all the great artists, Titian, Rubens, they've all done adoration scenes.
But this is the black king from like the nativity scene.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Bethlehem. You know,
it's a complete fiction. Never existed. No black king ever visited Britain at the time, Britain or Europe, you know. Yeah. It's a made of fabricated image to fit a narrative about power and status. And I ranted about this in my essay and continued to rant for a number of years. And until I got involved with Miranda Kaufman, we did a thing called Image and Reality, Black Africans in Renaissance Europe. This was 2013. And she in her PhD research, she found 300 plus black Africans fleeting, you know, Margarita Blackmore buried, people christened and so on. Just small references. And she put it together. She backfilled to create their lives. But she just had two images of one man, John Blank. There was a series of murals done for the underpass at Tower Hill of the life of Henry VIII. And one of them included a scene from the Westminster Tunnel Roll, which includes John Blank. And it's done by an artist called Stephen B. Watley. And he'd done a work for Miranda, a beautiful work, a pencil work. And I thought, well, maybe I could get a picture of John Blank, ask him to do one. And he created that first image. It got me thinking, because I thought, well, maybe I could get other artists. I liked the idea of the A4. The A4 format and the black and white. I wanted the black and white images because that's what I could afford, but also you get the aesthetic. I asked the artists, could you do me your version of John Blank? And I had the idea, could you imagine John Blank? Because this is what we think he looked like, because the image is essentially a caricature. It's not really John Blank, it's an image and impression. It's clearly a black man blowing a trumpet. Many of them artists took on the challenge. It started to grow. Become a bit of, almost like an obsession with the artist. And then someone said, can I do some poetry? And then it grew. And that's how it started. So I got the collection. How it became a project was then I thought, well, we've got all these artists. Well, maybe historians can say a few words. So let's get historians to kind of backfill. Like, where did that name come from? Who did he marry? You know, where did he go when he left the court? Because we know from 1507 to about 1512. Mm. But before that and after that, literally a mystery.
Yeah. What did he look like?
Glad you asked. Check the book out. No, we don't know. There's an impression of him.
Right.
But there's not a sympathetic
representation.
No. So you can tell this is the artist representing a black person rather than reproducing.
In that, the great Westminster role, the tournament role, the portrait of John Blank, he has a turban. So does that tell us maybe he came from somewhere in Europe, Spain maybe, possibly?
Yeah, keep going.
He was a Moor, maybe.
Yeah, keep going. Those are all possibilities.
These are all speculation.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And that's a key part of the project. And for me, it's that speculation that he exists, and you can do it intelligent, critical thinking, reflection, using your imagination. Then, well, could he possibly be? Because many people cannot imagine a Black Tudor.
And we know about John Blank because he's in the archive.
Exactly.
So all we have to do is look and he's there.
Do you know, as my mum said, what can't speak can't lie.
Right.
He's there, the image and the record. Get over it, you know. Yeah. They were there. Not in great numbers. Yeah. You know, we're not ruling the planet, but we're there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have, as you say, artists, poets, academics, historians, graphic designers, painters, musicians, who are all kind of reimagining, you know, John Blank. But do you think it's an important for you as a Black man, and we can hear your Scouser, you know, accent there, do you think it's important for you as a Black man to come to him, to write about
100%, 100%. Because as my mum used to say, it's good to see your face. And you know what I'm talking about, Mike. Yeah, when you go somewhere, you don't want to see hundreds and thousands, but just one or two. You nod. You're the nod. It's good. And it almost became, well, it is an obsession. In terms of history, he's not a Louis Armstrong or Hugh Masekela. You know, he's not changing the planet or the way people perceive. But the fact that he was there, that black trumpet presence in the royal court, you can span over those 500 years and there are images of black people in the 18th century, 19th century, right up to the 21st century. And I'm fortunate to have Lawrence Narkom. He's a Grenadier Guards trumpeter. He would have played at Charles III's birthday party in the same way John Blank would have played 500 years earlier, would have played Henry VIII's birthday parties and other celebrations.
Yeah, yeah.
And that continuity, that black presence. Now, I'm not a great royalist, I'm not, to be honest with you. Oh, you know. But on the other hand,
I won't tell anybody.
No. On the other hand, that sense of continuity.
Yeah.
We were here. Yeah. We're not great, but there's a presence.
Quite a few of the artists reference John Black in relation to Louis Armstrong, Wynton Marsalis, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
Courtney Pine, Shabaka,
bring it on,
you know,
exactly.
So all about contemporary or modern black male trumpeters.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they are kind of bringing John Blank from the past into the present.
Exactly.
Coming back to yourself though, coming from Liverpool, what does he speak to you? What does he say to you?
My father's Nigerian.
Yeah.
My mother was born in England, but her father was from Barbados.
Right.
And her mother was from Ireland.
Yeah.
So I'm a real child of the colonies.
Yeah.
You know? So when I go to Nigeria, they call me the Oyibo, the white man. And you may have experienced this yourself when you go to the Caribbean. You're the Englishman.
But we look alike, don't we?
You're the European.
That's right.
You're the Englishman. And that sense of, you know, and it took me a long time. And now I'm in my 70s. I come to the end, I'm here. I'm British. This is my home. I live here.
Yeah.
I am me. I'm black and British.
Yeah.
I'm not claiming to be anything else. This is who I am. So it's helped me really galvanize myself.
Yeah.
Put my feet on the ground and say, I own this land. You know, not own the land. I'm part of this land. I'm part of Britain. Get over it.
I mean, because the reason I ask that, Michael, is that for us as artists, as creatives, to have an obsession, we've got to have some personal investment in it, haven't we? And that's why I'm asking you that question. There's something in a sense that we're looking almost for ourselves within the work, aren't we?
Exactly. You know, come on, it's good to see your face. Good to see yourself. Let me turn it around, Michael. If there's nothing of the artist in the art, then it's of nothing.
You're obviously dealing with the institutions. Institutions and academics who, before you came along with this project, might have erased or hidden a figure like John Blank. I mean, what was that? What were the challenges dealing with the institutions now, who now were beginning to acknowledge that there was a presence?
I was talking to some friends the other day about this, how we've come such a long way.
Mm.
Black British history has become almost become normalized. It's become standard. And John Blank is almost a household name. Yeah. You know, he's a poster boy. He's on the front of magazines. He'd be on the BBC. It's accepted. And many institutions, if you go in the National Archive now, there's a page on John Blank. And I'm very proud of in the National Portrait Gallery. John Blank is now part of the Tudor Galleries. And that's only thanks to the work of artists like yourself, historians, who contributed to the black presence, making it real, making it relevant. You know, I'm particularly thinking of Marika Sherwood, a stalwart. She's passed away recently. She's a real back in the day person, writing about, you know, the Krumah, the Pan-Africanism, look, putting black history or black British history, the empire, on the map. And not shouting into the void, but not as well accepted, but we've come a long way now. We've almost normalized that history. So as far as the institutions, now it's almost become, you know, mainstream. One of my relatives said they, her children were done, did John Blank in primary school, did a little session on him. So it's like the curate's egg, you know. It's good in parts, you know. But we have come a long way, and there's no going back now. There's a cohort of young historians. Mainly female historians, I've got to have to, black historians, and they're doing some powerful work, bringing some extraordinary stories to life. So no, there's momentum there, but it's not as, more is better, of course. We are making progress. We've progressed, and we're moving on.
Amongst the kind of many interpretations and reimaginings that you have, one of them that's potentially controversial is the AI-generated image of John Blank. Now, what was the approach there rather than using a living artist, for instance? Because that speaks to, you know, AI-generated imagery at this moment.
Well, this is about 18 months ago, and AI just started. Let me put my cards on the table. I'm committed to AI as the future. It is. It is here, and it's growing, and it's changing quickly. And AI, it seemed, if I was starting the project then, I would have just gone straight to AI, and I don't think there would have been all these other images.
Really?
I think because it's quite late in the day the AI came on the scene, and so I saw that as in some ways, like, you may not agree with this, Michael, but I see that as a natural part of the book. And in fact, that AI image was hard to generate because we couldn't get it the prompt to do what it said it could do. Anyway, so we had to use ChatGPT for the words. And for the image we used, the Midjourney.
But so what can AI give that we as humans can't? I mean, because in a way, what if you're suggesting if you did the book now, you'd use AI? Well, where is our human agency in that?
We do profiles of an 18th century county sheriff. What did it look like? We build a profile, you know, 2,000-3,000 word profile, and then we put that into as a prompt to create, and then they create this white guy. Then I say, make him black. So they make this black guy from this white guy image. It's an imagined image. And this is where the thought comes from. You look at that image and say, yeah, that's how I imagined him. No, it's not. Because images are the key part of the way we work and think. Mm-hmm. So the AI, this recovered images, these created images, these fabricated images, are a way of helping us understand the past and critique the past in terms of, no, that's not.
But images aren't neutral.
Exactly. No, but then it's us who brings the confusion and the concern and the worry or the positivity about the image. It's in our head, and it's in your head. And that's where I think AI can really help us literally get inside your head, but equally to your imagination and your critical
thinking. So do you
see
AI as neutral in the sense that a lot of people have talked about AI, artificial intelligence, right? It's embedded, humans create it. But the people who create it are largely white men. So their own unconscious biases are embedded within the algorithms within AI. And there is a problem.
No, I get where you're coming from, but I would argue this way. Back in the day, we used to talk about the internet. If it's out there, it's in here. Yeah?
Yes.
And these large language models consume data. They want data. That's their raison d'etre, to consume.
Yeah.
So as they consume more, then the more black people involved. So
Is that an assumption?
No, it's a fact. It's a fact.
There are more black people.
The one it consumes, it'll integrate. How it uses that, it's indifferent. It just puts things together, A, then B. It goes on a journey in its own mind to create this image. It has no, there's no malice of forethought as it goes on a journey. In some ways, it's indifferent. We bring, this is a negative image. It's in our head. The end of it, you know, imagine, and that's why it's good in the sense that it can help us to understand ourselves. We can say that's a good black image, a negative black image. It's, you know, it's a matter of interpretation. And as AIs get, as the database gets better, they get to know more, then I would argue that this idea of they're prejudiced. I think, you know, maybe at the early days, but as we got closer, the better at interpreting.
So what you're saying, it depends on how informed you are in the questions you ask AI. Because there are many, many instances, Michael, where people have used AI and the representations that come up are, if not racist, are exclusive. They don't include us. We must actually be critically aware as we move into the future with AI and not kind of be naive and not just say, well, actually, the machine here is indifferent. No, it's not necessarily indifferent. And we have to be critically aware. One of the, for instance, software recognition. We know the problem with software recognition, right, is that statistics have shown that people of color have been misidentified. What's that about? This is where I'm going with AI here. Do you see where I'm coming? We need to be critically aware.
No, okay. Let me answer it in two ways. One, that critical aware. Critical thinking is a key part of my project here. Your imagination, your critical thinking faculties working together.
Mm.
Is this real? And for me, that's really important. That makes you not susceptible to conspiracy theories. You question, you challenge them. And at the same time, the technology is progressing so fast.
Mm.
The quality of the work it produces is getting better and better. So that inability to get black faces, it's getting better. Now, then you could argue, I reckon, well, it's the other way, we're going the other way now. They've programmed it that way. Someone has done something. Yeah, now I believe that is certainly possible.
Right.
But the technology we have today is sophisticated enough to just to see people as they are, because they have the skills with the right lights, even very low lights and seeing from different angles. We have the ability to discriminate. And when they don't, then maybe there's something going on. Because as I say, I think these machines are indifferent.
So would you say, Michael, that you're a disciple of modernity in terms of the social progress of machines and technology?
It's the future. Get over it. In the sense, we've got to handle it, how we work with it. If you're an artist, you've got a tool there, which is at your disposal to do anything you want. It's a brilliant tool. Then you have to think, well, where's my value add? What do I bring to it? And this is where I think, this is me personally.
Well, it goes back to this question. Sorry to cut. It goes back to this question. Where is the humanness, the human presence in AI? Because otherwise, Michael, you know, we can talk about the value and progress of machines, but what does that then say about us as human beings in terms of our creativity? You know, I work a lot now with students who produce AI-generated essays.
And
they're very clinical, they're very sterile and unhuman. There's no human presence.
You can tell.
That's right. There's no mistakes. So the question is, what do they learn?
I'll give you 2 points on that. One, the first, how students should confront AI. AI is there. You've got to get over it. You've got to use it. You've got to find your voice, your way. You've got to find your humanity, whatever that is. And it may be hard in your chosen media, but you've got to find it, it's there. The second thing is, and this is a bit of a bit of emotion on my side. I don't think there's a thing called genius. You know, when you look at solutions to great mathematical problems, and we ask them, "How did you do that?" Well, I just did it. Or equally, Michelangelo when he does the Pietà, "How did you do that?" Well, I just did it. That sense of they create something, literally out of nothing that we can see. Was these large language model AI models? They're producing stuff that's been produced before, and what you bring to you put it together in a different way. But it's something that existed before, so it's creating that something special, something different, something genius, and that's the challenge that students have. It's easy for me to tell them, and I've talked a lot to them about it, but they've got to find their voice. It's a tool, it's a very powerful tool.
Mm.
You've got to find how you can use it. You can't deny it.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to maybe agree to disagree on it. But I'm really, I think it's an important issue kind of raise. It's an important subject to talk about.
Very.
And it's an ongoing conversation I think we have to have.
very much.
I mean, one of the easy answers at the moment is immigration, and the toxic kind of xenophobic kind of response to immigration. And it's like, for our age, it's like, oh, here we go again. It's like, here we go again, a deja vu. And do you think, in a sense, that John Blank, the presence of John Blank 500 years ago, talks to the black presence in Britain, which kind of says, actually, we've been here a long time. People would say since the Romans.
Yeah.
But your contribution has said, actually, definitively, he was a black man. He was part of the royal court. He was a musician, a talented musician. He made his own. Yeah, he had a life. He was an individual. Yeah. He was probably free. He probably was a free man.
He was paid wages. Yeah,
he paid wages.
And he left. The king gave him a wedding present.
So he had his own agency.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talked about Afrofuturism in the past. So that kind of sense of the past and the present is really crucial.
No, I think that's so important. That sense of continuity. We were here and we are here and we will be here. An invaluable Tudor portrait by Jan Marsh, historian and curator. Portraits of non-noble sitters in Tudor Britain are very rare, because this new form of visual art in the 16th century was aimed at sustaining the fame and power of high-status individuals. Lesser folk might have pictorial images in woodcuts or manuscript illustrations, but these are often crude and typically generic representations, but recognizable figures. The black trumpet in the 1511 tournament role is therefore amazing on many levels. Now, this is John Agar's poem. And respect to John Agar, I can't read it with your intensity or your emotion, but I'll try. John Blank by John Agar. In Norman French, the name has a ring that's nice. Not John the Blanc, Jean Blanc, to be precise. Shall we say a Tudor gentleman of colour, or one who brought colour to the Tudor court? What's in the name leaves ample room to ponder. Am I not John White the Black, and the Black John White rolled into one turban? In days when the Henrys ruled the royal roost, and the king himself took to the manly joust, I hailed the thrust of lance with trumpet blast, I, the equestrian exotic of the retinier, blowing for every pence of my shilling's due. Thus the North African winds had followed me to an England known both as old and merry. Yes, I, whose Moorish skin echoed midnight's key, surveyed from a turban's rainbow my adopted Albion, and to those white cliffs my lips put forth their clarion. Not quite a fanfare for diversity, simply doing my bit for pomp and pageantry. Yet when history's footnotes begin to grow more bold, and the heart's tapestry unrolls its spectrum, hear again my trumpet's dark riffs rising out of vellum. I love that what he says. Not quite a fanfare for diversity, simply doing my bit for pomp and pageantry.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael McMillan was talking to Michael Orojuri. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.